the unexplained deaths of a 37-year-old woman and her two children, aged 6 and 11, in a quiet residential area in South Dublin, generates the lead story in six of today's papers in The Republic. Residents of Llewellyn Court in Rathfarnham, who attended the candlelit vigil on the estate where the deaths occurred, are pictured on the front of the Irish Times and Irish Independent, while most of today's other papers run with front page pictures of Gardaí and forensic officers at the scene yesterday. All of today's papers report that the family had been living in the house for about a year and that the children had attended the local primary school. It is also reported that Gardaí had been in contact with the woman's husband and the children's father. The Irish Examiner and Times find their lead stories elsewhere this morning. The Examiner leads with the line that survivors of mother and baby homes will be able to seek access to their personal records after the government clarified concerns raised by furious survivors. Children's Minister Roderick O'Gorman is quoted saying that while the Attorney General has clarified that access is permissible under strict conditions, all cases will be assessed on their individual merits. It is not absolute access by any means, he asserts. Daniel McConnell and Aoife Moore also writes that cabinet ministers have admitted that the government is badly shook by this controversy and the establishment of the Cervical Check Tribunal, which have enraged campaigners and survivors. For its lead story, The Times reports on the restrictive measures being enforced all around Europe in the fight against COVID-19. Bars and restaurants have been shut for a month in Germany, where cases have reached 15,000 a day, while France has gone into a second national lockdown for the month of November, as 254,000 cases were recorded there over the course of a week. Closer to home, the Irish News leads with the death of a 17-year-old from Derry, whose death was recorded as one of nine deaths in Northern Ireland yesterday. For its lead story, the Belfast Telegraph reports that officials in Stormont handed out more than £4.5 million to businesses which weren't eligible to receive grants from the Small Business Support Grant Scheme in March. Sinn Féin received three unsolicited grants amounting to £30,000, which the party repaid last week. Elsewhere on the front pages, the Department of Education has insisted that schools are safe places for staff and students as ASTI members yesterday backed potential strike action over coronavirus-related concerns. That's on the front of the Times. And finally, the Examiner reports in its front page today that Douglas Shopping Centre in Cork, which was destroyed by fire in August 2018, is to reopen on the 12th of November. Although many of the units in the centre, which aren't deemed essential under Level 5, won't open immediately, we're told that Tesco and Marks and Spencers have already started restocking their shelves.
Welcome back. You're with Morning Ireland at 12 minutes past seven. Now, yesterday's cabinet meeting spent a long time talking about the controversy over the government's handing of the mother and baby homes records and ended with a decision that adoptees and survivors of mother and baby's homes are legally entitled to access their personal data in the Commission's files. We'll be speaking to Children's Minister Roderick O'Gorman after eight about this. Let's get the details now from Mary Regan of our political staff. And a week ago, Mary, this was a hugely passionate and emotional debate in the Dáil, this legislation. Why did the matter take up so much cabinet time yesterday, and what's the latest?
Yeah, well, as you said, Áine, when these were debated in the Dáil last week, they exposed some really deeply held views amongst politicians. There was distrust around what the government was trying to do. But the debate also caused a lot of distress to adoptees or people who were born in these homes. And I spoke to some of them yesterday, and they were saying at a time when there's already heightened anxiety around, and as they wait for the publication of this report, you know, this sort of debate was really unhelpful to them. So this all amounted to a sort of wider backlash that I think really took the coalition by surprise. And they acknowledged really that a more appropriate response was needed. And on top of this, there was that statement from President Higgins when he signed the bill into law on Sunday night, saying that there were concerns raised during discussions that were serious and had to be addressed. So, of course, this left a lot for the cabinet to reflect on yesterday. And they issued a very lengthy statement last night saying that they acknowledged and regretted that genuine hurt felt, and they outlined what they see as a number of steps now that they hope will address some of those issues. The main one, I suppose, is in relation to the report of the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes itself. Now, that report, it runs to 4,000 pages. It has been described and reported to be described as harrowing, and it will be given to the government tomorrow. Now, they have to send it firstly to the Attorney General for review before it's published. So the Cabinet yesterday committed to publish it as quickly as possible, and they said extra resources will be given to the AG's office to ensure that is done. But crucially, there is no timeline specifically for when it will come out. But meanwhile, they took a number of other steps aimed at what they say is addressing those very deeply held concerns around access to personal information.
Yes, this is the right of adoptees and survivors to access their own data. And the argument was between the Attorney General's advice and because there was previous existing law on sealing commission records, and between the Data Protection Commissioner's advice on the supremacy of data protection legislation. So in terms of the government's position, has there been a change in position? Has the advice of the Attorney General changed? What has changed since last week?
In some ways, it's a sort of clarification of a legal interpretation, if you want to put it that way, because first of all, there is this law dating from 2004 that means that when commissions of investigations wind up, that they have to give all unpublished records to the government to seal for 30 years. So that is one aspect of the law. Then the reason the laws were passed in the Dáil last week, according to the government, were to give a lot of this information in a database to TUSLA, so those records would be available for the purpose of people when they wanted them for tracing and information about their own families. Now, the minister said yesterday that he consulted with the Attorney General in relation to the file that is going to his department. That is the file that is described as being sealed. And he confirmed from the Attorney General that it is subject to GDPR rules, rules around access to data. In other words, people will be allowed to access their personal data. The government is clarifying that is their rights. And the government is saying it will work with the Data Protection Commissioner and TUSLA to ensure those rights are respected, and also will give them extra resources where needed.
We'll be speaking to campaigner Claire McGettrick before 8 as well. But Mary, has there been much reaction from other campaigners or from opposition to the Cabinet's decision here?
Well, so far, the opposition hasn't put out any response directly in relation to this, because the statement just came in last night. But there has been response in relation to this clarification that people will be allowed to access their data, because there are some concerns being raised about the fact that this is not an absolute right, that it will be weighed up against other rights. So the minister is saying that any data requested will have to be considered on the basis of whether it impacts on the rights and freedoms of others, but it will also have to be considered on the basis of whether it impacts on the commission of investigation or future commission of investigations. And there are some experts, Simon McGarr, a solicitor specialising in the area of data rights, is saying that, you know, he is questioning this condition. And also Ahanthus, which is one of the groups that's organising this campaign called Repeal the Seal, is saying it's not, you know, with the tests that have to be applied here. It says that last night we wanted the government to move house, and they've just redecorated and reshuffled the furniture. So I think there will be more questions around those particular caveats to that clarification throughout today.
Okay, and we'll attempt to get some clarity on that later in the programme. For the moment, Mary Regan of our political staff.
When Ireland West Airport opened for business in 1985, it was known simply as the airport up at Knock. Despite some gloomy predictions, the airport thrived and provides employment and connectivity to the North West. Until the pandemic hit, it had closed only once and then for a day during the 2010 ash cloud. But this pandemic has already closed the airport for 3 months earlier this year, and Ryanair's decision to suspend operations for 4 weeks from November 14th sees Knock or Ireland West closing once again. The CEO of Ireland West Airport is Joe Gilmore. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Mary.
These are grim times for the aviation industry. Is it the end of the line for now for Ireland West Airport with the announcement from Ryanair?
Yeah, Mary, just to give just some brief context, and you've outlined it in the introduction, we're looking at a business here that's grown over the last 30 years, a community-owned airport, part of the broader aviation sector that contributes $9 billion to the economy and 140,000 jobs. In our own case, as you outlined, we were heading to 1 million passengers this year, supporting critical connectivity across the UK and Europe, supporting with 250 people employed, supporting 3,000 jobs. For us, we've been brought to our knees. We've seen a near total collapse of air services. passenger numbers, revenues and employment at the airport. You know, in addition to the broader impact along the whole Western Seaboard for leisure and business, for us, we've seen 90% reduction in passengers. We've laid off two-thirds of our staff. We've gone through redundancies. We're in short-time work. And like many businesses, we've worked through multiple phases. So we've been through the wars. Look, at we recognize we're the same as many businesses in the hospitality aviation sectors. But now we're facing a complete suspension of services for the second time this year.
How many jobs are we talking about here, Joe?
In terms of airport itself, we're looking at over 100 jobs being impacted directly, and as I said, we're supporting 3,000 jobs across the region. In addition to that, Mary, we're looking at a serious risk now of permanent loss of critical air access to the west of Ireland. You know, we're looking at the future viability of the business comes into question because we're shipping massive losses incurred despite cost containment measures we've taken. You know, and there's a risk that in the future, not alone for our own airport here, but along the whole Western Seaboard, that we lose critical connectivity. It will be seriously impacted as a result.
Joe, does it have to be like this? Do you join in the criticism voiced particularly by Ryanair about the government that they were telling people not to fly? Ryanair said Neffet was demonising the aviation industry. Does it have to be like this?
Mary, we're a small airport, and we were pleased in June last to be invited to be part of the national discussion on this. And I was personally appointed to the Government Aviation Recovery Task Force and was happy to be part of that. And that had key stakeholders from across the aviation sector, government and the unions. But in the summary, and this was published on July the 7th, and I quote, it said, each day and passing week, confusion and stagnation, the Irish aviation sector increases the probability of job losses, long-term loss of connectivity, unbalanced regional development and economic damage. And we're seeing that in the last 5 months. We're now 5 months into it, and it's clear from the recent Oireachtas hearings yesterday that the key recommendations in the areas of protecting public health, rebuilding confidence, rebuilding regional and international connectivity, and saving jobs, they require urgent attention by government. We recognise government have had significant challenges. The task force clearly accepted public health concerns, but as an island nation, we have to economically coexist with the virus, and that has to include international travel.
Eamon Ryan said yesterday they are adopting the European system, the green, amber and red system, amber being rolled out, I think he said, from the 8th of November. Is it coming too late for you and Dnoc?
Well, it's never too late, but We urge government to implement the key recommendations. You know, in particular on the public health and opening up air access, on the green list, the traffic light system, we need clarity and definition into regard the lifting of restrictions.
Do you anticipate, Joe, a testing system at Ireland West Airport?
We do. We're ready to go. However, we need clarification on what the protocols and testing...
The system is. Well, Eamon Ryan seemed clear. Eamon Ryan was talking yesterday about the what he called the gold standard, the PCR system, as opposed to antigen testing.
Yes, well, decisions need to be taken in relation to which testing protocols will be put in place. But what is clear is we need to urgently open up the economy. For example, Mary, we have Christmas coming up here. We would typically have over 50,000 people from the UK that wish to visit their loved ones along the west and northwest. We're getting phone calls here now whether we can reopen in December, what the situation will be in terms of booking flights and making arrangements. These people would love to get back for Christmas. We'd love to have a testing system in place at the airport that we could facilitate that.
Money promised it from Eamon Ryan as well from the budget contingency funds. Have you received money so far?
Just to acknowledge the support we've got to date, as you know, we have benefited from the broad-based EWSS, the rates relief from government, and yeah, that has been very welcome. We're also part of a regional airports programme, and we welcomed Minister Nocton's announcement in the budget of supports for airports. However, they need to implement the recommendations in the task force report. For ourselves, in relation to regional airports funding, we're seeking an enhanced regional airports funding package. In normal times, the current airports programme is sufficient to support airports like ourselves to reach a break-even situation. Right. Unfortunately, this year we're sustaining losses in the region of 4 million. In addition to that, Mary, the other key recommendations, just briefly, the airlines need support to restore critical air access both Dublin and the regional airports. And likewise, the airports, will need ongoing CAPEX support to make sure that we can be ready for the recovery and to play our part once this pandemic passes.
Joe, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us. Joe Gilmore there from Ireland West Airport. It's 24 minutes past seven.
And Ireland is no longer an outlier in Europe in bringing back lockdown level restrictions. Soaring coronavirus infection rates and rapidly filling hospitals mean the German and the French governments are bringing back tough limits on people's movements to try to stop the spread of the disease. Let's start with the situation in France. Sharon Gaffney from France 24 is on the line. Sharon, the Prime Minister, French President Emmanuel Macron, he addressed the nation last night. What did he say?
Yes, during a 20-minute televised address, Emmanuel Macron outlined his concerns, really, with the surge in cases of coronavirus that we've seen here in recent weeks. He actually warned that the situation could be deadlier during this second wave of the virus. And really, until Tuesday night, we had been generally expecting here that we might not be subjected to a second lockdown. We thought that perhaps the curfew that's currently in place for 46 million people across the country, that that might be extended, or that a weekend curfew might be introduced instead. But really, we had yesterday the president meeting with his defence council at the Elysee Palace and also with senior ministers and the prime minister. So it started to become clear yesterday that there would actually potentially be a national lockdown announced. And that's what happened at about 8 o'clock last night. Now, the president was coming under a lot of pressure from hospitals and health experts here, because we've seen the case numbers just spiral out of control, really, in the last couple of weeks. We had 36,000 cases reported yesterday. And on Sunday night, we actually had 52,000 cases of the virus. And the president said in his speech last night that actually the true number could be far higher, possibly even double the figures that we're seeing reported every day. Now, the lockdown, there was one here, of course, back in the spring, an 8-week lockdown, very severe restrictions. The president suggested that this one won't be quite as strict as that one. Schools will remain open, factories, farms will also be able to operate, some public services will be open. But people will have to remain more or less within their homes. They'll be allowed leave for 1 hour per day, but you must stay within 1 kilometre of your home. You can leave to go to work, to go to the doctor, to go shopping, to bring children to school, or to care for somebody who's vulnerable. But even in order to do that, you need to have an attestation, or a document that you have to download from the government website and fill in, just to give to police in case you are stopped on the street. So lockdown here, it's going to be in place for 4 weeks initially, and the president said last night that he hopes that people will be able to celebrate Christmas and the new year with their families. So the situation is going to be reviewed every 2 weeks, and we're expecting further details to be announced by the prime minister when he speaks to reporters later on this evening.
Sharon, thank you for giving us that picture in France. And journalist Jessica Salz is standing by in Berlin. And Jessica, Germany was praised for its handling of the first wave. How it's coping with this second wave as winter takes hold?
Well, the cases in Germany aren't as high as they are in somewhere like France, but they still are growing exponentially, and that is of great concern. We were told this morning by the Robert Koch Institute that a new record has been set for a daily infection rate of over 16,700. And yes, as I say, they are growing exponentially, something which Angela Merkel has said yesterday is of great concern. And she said if these cases carry on like this, growing exponentially, then Germany's health organisations really run the risk of losing control of being able to handle the spread of the virus. So the German Chancellor enforcing new nationwide measures, a lockdown light, they're calling it here. It will begin on Monday, November the 2nd, and last until the end of November, really restricting quite a lot of sort of private and public life. Restaurants and bars and clubs are going to be closed during that period, as well as leisure facilities, swimming pools, gyms, cultural activities will be restricted. Operas and cinemas and theatres are going to be closed. And also citizens are being told to just really restrict the contact that they have with other people. Private and public events and celebrations are going to be banned. And people can only socialise with members of one other household. The German government here has for weeks been warning people that they need to keep their social contact to a minimum to try and stop the spread of the virus. But they really feel that they haven't had this message heard. So this is really a way of enforcing it.
What's the basis for retail staying open, Jessica?
Well, retail is staying open for as long as shops are large enough and can enforce hygiene measures safely and securely. So this means that they can have one customer per 10 square metres. And of course, all masks it's obligatory in Germany that you wear masks in shops. And for shops that are too small or that can't handle a capacity of customers coming in, they will be forced to close. We are hearing from Germany's finance minister that they are earmarking upwards of 10 billion euros to support small businesses, as well as the other industries I mentioned, gastronomy and the hotel industry and the cultural institutions that are going to suffer, because obviously they're going to be affected hugely by this.
Jessica Salz in Berlin, and before that, Sharon Gaffney in France. Thank you both.
It's 7:32. Let's take a first look at the business headlines now with Petula Martin.
Thanks, Mary. Good morning. Tesco is to create 450 new permanent jobs across the country. The supermarket chain is also generating an additional 700 seasonal positions for the Christmas period. Global nutrition group Glanbia has announced it intends to launch a share repurchase programme of up to 50 million euro. The board made the decision as a result of the strong cash flows in the business, which provides an opportunity to allocate capital to benefit shareholders. Contactless payments hit a record high in the third quarter of this year, with more than 182 million payments valued at almost 2.9 billion euro, according to figures published today by Banking and Payments Federation Ireland. Samsung Electronics has reported record revenues of $59 billion in its third quarter, fueled by a 50% jump in smartphone sales, while profits from microchips rocketed 82%. Business at the Korean tech giant was likely boosted by US sanctions against its Chinese rival Huawei. On the currencies, 1 euro buys 90.3 pence sterling and $1.17.5 cents.
25 to 8, here's Des with the sports news.
Yeah, Anya, and we're going to chat about Marcus Rashford, the Manchester United striker. Off the pitch, he's been making headlines with his battle to highlight child hunger. He's had a petition to end child food poverty and has a million signatures. And it's one of only five parliamentary petitions of Britain to attract a million signatures. It's remarkable that he's only 22 years of age and has such a social conscience. But last night he made all the headlines on the pitch. He came off the bench to score a hat-trick as Manchester United continued their recent momentum by hammering the German league leaders RB Leipzig 5-0 in the Champions League. Rashford came on just after the hour mark and scored three goals in 16 minutes. Mason Greenwood and Anthony Martial got the other goals. Let's hear from Marcus Rashford.
You know, I think the manager just told us, I mean, come on, try and up the tempo. And of course, as it means going forward. And, you know, there was definitely spaces there. And, you know, today we managed to find the passes. We got Bruno on the ball, Paul on the ball, Anto running forward. And, you know, we look dangerous with that. We could score every time we go forward.
Hugely impressive win for United. Elsewhere, Chelsea were also impressive. They won 4-0 away to the Russian side Krasnodar, and amongst their goal scorers was their expensive new signing, Ziyech, signed from Ajax, who hasn't been able to play because of injury up to now. But a 4-0 away win for Chelsea. The big game of the night saw Lionel Messi score again as Barcelona won 2-0 at Juventus. Juve did not have Ronaldo playing for them, but Barca finished the game with two 17-year-olds on the pitch. Meanwhile, back at home in the SSE Electricity League in Ballybuffet, Finn Harps had a dramatic 3-2 victory over St Patrick's Athletic to boost their chances of avoiding the relegation playoff. It follows up on their 2-0 win at Bohemians at the weekend, and Finn Harps are now just 2 points behind Shelburne, St Pat's and Derry, and Shells have a game in hand. Our Finn Harps have a game in hand on Shells. The big match tonight, though, is attracting all the headlines. It sees Dundalk take on Arsenal at the Emirates Stadium in the Europa League. It's a glamour match. It's a shame for the Dundalk players. It can't be played in front of a full house. The Dundalk manager, Filippo Giovagnoli, says they will try to match Arsenal's intensity and get a result that would be a huge boost for Irish football. But most of all, he wants his players to enjoy it.
Well, I would love to say play, you know, relaxed, composed, and don't be nervous and just try to perform at their best and show their quality, show our idea of soccer. That will be the best thing to do. And I'm going to tell them for sure to have fun. This is the best part.
Good luck to Dundalk. In other games tonight, Celtic go to Lille, Rangers play Lech Poznan, Spurs go to Antwerp, and Leicester City play AEK Athens. In rugby, Ireland's final Women's Six Nations game against France has been postponed at the weekend because of an outbreak of COVID-19 in the French squad. The game was due to be played in Donnybrook on Sunday. It was originally due to be played in France, but because Ireland would have had to isolate for 14 days when they come back, the French generously offered to come here, but now the game has been put back. It's hoped to play it next month. In Gaelic games, the Waterford Intermediate Football Champions Dungarvan have been stripped of their county title for fielding a player who was awaiting the results of a COVID-19 test, which subsequently returned positive. The county board confirmed the proposed penalties have been accepted by the club, so Dungarvan lose their county title and individual suspensions have been imposed on six club members. In cycling, Dan Martin continued his impressive form at the Vuelta a España. His third place finish on stage 8 saw the Irishman stay third in the general classification. He's 28 seconds behind the overall race leader, Richard Carapaz. In racing, John Ox was back amongst the winners at Dundalk last night. Ross Coakley steered Regal Eagle to victory. And today's racing is at Clonmel. The first race is at 1:20.
And let's go back to the controversy over the mother and baby homes records. Claire McGettrick, co-founder of the Adoption Rights Alliance and co-founder of Justice for Magdalens, good morning to you.
Good morning, Anya.
Can you give us your reaction to the Cabinet statement yesterday? I presume you welcome the decision on the Cabinet on recognising that people, adoptees and survivors of mothers and babies homes will be able to access their records in certain circumstances.
Well, we welcome the new approach taken by the government. We warmly welcome it. It's a very, very welcome departure of the events that we've seen over the past couple of weeks. We agree with the U-turn on obviously on GDPR provision of access to records. However, we believe that in order for the effective and respectful and fair implementation of the GDPR, it is absolutely crucial to have data protection law experts installed both in the Department of Children and Youth Affairs immediately in Tuzla, who already are in the business of information provision, and indeed in every other situation where records of adoption and institutional abuse are held.
And in terms of the records themselves, that there was such debate about, the adoptees and the survivors, do I understand it that they are now acknowledged by government to have the right to seek, but not necessarily to get their records? The terms and conditions apply. Is that the case?
Yes. Now, under the GDPR, I'm not a legal expert, but the legal our legal advisors tell us that there is a balancing act under GDPR. From what I've seen so far, it was late, this all happened quite late last night. But from what I've seen so far, some experts are raising questions about the government's interpretation in terms of the tests it's going to apply in that.
I'm sorry to cut across you, but does that mean that there's a concern that maybe the terms and conditions for getting access to your own data, that they may be too restrictive? Is that what you're worried about?
Well, yes, absolutely, because the state's practice to date has been unfortunately appalling, particularly in Tuzla. So therefore, it's absolutely crucial to have data protection experts installed in, as I say, the department, independent experts of the department and of Tuzla and of any department indeed involved in providing information from these records.
And of course, the report itself from the Commission goes to the Minister tomorrow. And obviously, there's a process before it can be made public. Do you realistically think there's any chance of seeing it before Christmas?
I don't know the answer to that because I haven't seen the report. But we know from the fallout of Ryan, of the Ryan Commission, you know, the a huge problem was the lack of prosecution. So you know, I wouldn't want to preempt any of that, obviously, so or prejudice anything. But you know, that's really,
so better
really
to
important.
Get it right than rush publication.
Well, indeed. And you know, while, you know, as I say, when I mentioned the Ryan Commission, we also stress that this new position has huge implications for people with records at the McAleese, of the McAleese Archive, people with records of the Ryan Commission. They should also be provided with their records immediately, because the GDPR applies across the board, and we welcome the state's acknowledgement of that.
Okay, and those are points we put to the minister when he joins us after 8. For the moment, Claire McGettrick, co-founder of the Adoption Rights Alliance, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Morning Ireland at 8:16.
And turning to the agri sector now, and in pre-COVID times, up to 5,000 farmers would be gathered in Cork today for the National Dairy Show and Innovation Awards. Instead, they're tuning in remotely from their farms around the country. They'll be considering the state of the industry, the challenges the dairy sector is facing with Brexit and climate change, and the hit their export markets have taken with the pandemic. Carol Cassan is from Agri Insider magazine. He's also a dairy farmer in North Kerry. He's on the line. Carol, good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
Would it be fair to say that going into 2020, despite the Brexit cloud or climate issues, that there was a huge degree of optimism in the dairy industry, that 2020 was going to be a good year?
Yes, I would agree. We were after a solid 2019. Looking at the supply of dairy worldwide, it was roughly in a balance with demand, and we were very hopeful for a very, very strong dairy price year here in Ireland.
And then along came the pandemic. What impact has that had on the dairy industry here?
Well, I guess to start out, like when it hit first, let's say into the months of March and April, we were very, very fearful here in Ireland. It looked like that there was going to be a big crash in prices, and it could have been a very, very bad year. There was huge problems, say, with the supply chain. A lot of cold storage was caught in China, not being able to unload. And of course, we're such a big export market. If anything happens to the supply chains worldwide, it's really going to affect us drastically here in Ireland. But thankfully, that didn't quite play out as bad as we were fearing. And it's kind of evened out a bit, and it's probably not far from being on par with 2019, the way the year has turned out overall. So we're happy from what it was looking like, let's say, back in March and April, is what I would say.
So you have overcome the difficulties that you saw ahead in March and April. Have you seen growth in the sector?
We have indeed. Year on year for the last number of years, as you're aware, dairy has been growing here in Ireland, and it has continued on this year. Now, growth has slowed a bit, but we're still increasing output. Exports are growing at a reasonable rate, and so growth is still happening. There's still the demand there for the Irish dairy products worldwide, and I guess maybe because of the pandemic and maybe a little bit of fear in some of our markets like China, and that there's actually been a big uptick on the amount of dairy products that are being bought. So at the moment, the demand side is very strong, thankfully.
Now, did the pandemic and what was to follow, did that take attention away from Brexit? Because the Irish dairy industry has a huge export market to the UK.
I would say it did. Even personally, if we went back to this time last year, I was probably, and many people were probably, glued to almost a television on a nightly basis. It was like a soap opera almost in the UK, seeing what was happening with Brexit. And you were kind of almost looking at it through your fingers, kind of going, oh no, how is this going to affect us here in Ireland? And probably it's got more serious, what could happen in Brexit. But because of COVID, it's kind of almost distracted us from the seriousness of Brexit. So yeah, I would agree, the COVID has taken our focus and our fears away from Brexit. And it's still a big elephant in the room. And
if things
don't go right in the next few weeks, there could be huge trouble.
Sorry, Carl, is that a potential danger for you? Did you have the minister addressing you last night, the Minister for Agriculture?
We did indeed, but unfortunately with a live event and with broadband from Donegal and everything, the minister actually dropped out. But we're hoping to have him back on again tonight. So hopefully we can get a little bit longer tonight from him.
Okay, them's the breaks with connectivity at the moment. Can we move on to this whole question of climate change? You said you've had an uptick in the industry, an uptick in supply. Are we still increasing our dairy herd?
I would say there's a little bit of increase at the moment, but it has really slowed over the last maybe 2 years compared to what it was, say, when quotas first went. Now, I will agree, yeah, there's an uptick on the herd, but I would also say that there's an uptick as well on the farmer side of their awareness of their environmental responsibilities, and that actually it's a win-win situation. So I know in my own situation, all my slurry now is spread with low-emission technology slurry spreading, which reduces ammonia emissions by 80%. But on my side, it actually gives me better growth and better uptick of the nutrients. So there's a lot of awareness there from farmers of things that we probably need to do further that can actually help the environment, but also on the plus side, help us as farmers as well.
But the thing is, Carl, that awareness won't cut it, will it? I mean, the biggest emitters of greenhouse gases would be cattle and cows and the agri sector.
Well, I guess, yeah, if you look at Ireland as a standalone, that is the case because it's such a big industry here in Ireland. We don't have a huge manufacturing industry. So on a percentage basis, yes, we're very high. But if you look at us from a global perspective, now last night, one of our speakers was Donald Moore, who is from the global dairy platform. You look at Ireland, actually, we can actually produce dairy at a really, really low kind of emissions level. So, I mean, when you've got a world market where there's huge demand for dairy, I would almost say like it needs to be produced somewhere. So why not produce it where we can actually do it at a low emissions rate, but us as farmers, yes, need to be, I would say, even more aware, like that we have to do it in the most environmentally sustainable way possible.
Okay, Carl, we'll leave it there. Carl Cassan there from Agri Insider magazine, and I hope the Wi-Fi holds up for you today. It's 10 minutes to 8 o'clock. Petula Martin now with the business news.
Thanks, Mary. Tesco Ireland will create 1,150 jobs to support business operations in the run-up to Christmas. 450 are full-time permanent positions and 700 are seasonal. CEO of Tesco Ireland, Carrie Daniels, joins us this morning. Carrie, recruitment has already begun. In what areas of the business will successful applicants be working?
Oh, morning, Petula. Yes, we've got roles across all of our shops. We want to open our checkouts for longer and all of them be open. Pickers for grocery home shopping, drivers to deliver shops to our customers at their homes, and generally replenishing our shelves through the Christmas period.
Now, Tesco sells clothes and other items deemed non-essential. You were forced to shut those sections during Level 5 restrictions. Are all Tesco stores compliant now?
Absolutely. From the outset, we've followed government guidelines and done as requested. Our overall objective through all of this is to keep our colleagues and our customers safe when they're shopping with us. So we absolutely have followed all the guidelines. We just hope that
and
it's a challenging time.
Do you agree with closing
around
those sections of the stores?
We need to do what we need to do to keep our customers and colleagues safe. And we'll follow the guidelines. And when the government actually review the restrictions and it's safe to open those areas, then of course we will.
You're clearly expecting a busy Christmas with this recruitment drive. Now, introducing safety measures have been costly for all retailers, but Tesco remains profitable. Will you be passing any of that on to customers since every little helps?
No, not at all. I mean, overall, our priority has been the safety of our colleagues and our customers. So all the measures we put in, safety glass around our checkouts, our customer count monitors at the front of store, the signage, sanitizers, all are very, very important to keep everybody safe when they shop with us. And absolutely, we will not be passing the cost on to our customers.
But in terms of Tesco being profitable, will you be passing any of the benefits on to customers?
We are constantly reviewing our offers and our prices and making sure we're as competitive and as keenly priced as we can be. So that's an ongoing way we work generally.
Okay. Delivery drivers are among the new jobs. Has there been a big shift to online grocery shopping and home delivery at Tesco?
There absolutely has. I mean, we've seen in the last 6 months our online shopping double. We've doubled the capacity of our slots, so we've got more slots available, and we've doubled our sales in that area. And that's through grocery home shopping, delivering to our customers' homes, but also click and collect, which has proven very, very popular, where customers can pre-order at a designated time that suits them and is convenient to them. They can pop along to their store and pick their shop up. So basically through delivery to home and click and collect, we've seen a massive increase in demand. And as much as we keep adding vans and keep adding new sites, they're filling up. And what's been really popular actually is our over 65s free delivery. So we've seen more of those colleague, those customers shopping with us and making use of the free delivery, which I think they found very helpful through this time.
Something that's likely to be a permanent trend into the future. Carrie Daniel, CEO of Tesco Ireland, thanks for talking to us this morning. I'll have more business news at 8:30. Áine.
4 minutes to eight now, and Paul Downs at Met Éireann has the weather forecast.
Well, Áine, it's a wet start across the country with winds increasing this morning. There's a status yellow rainfall warning in effect for the western half of the country today, and a status yellow wind warning will come into effect for Galway and Mayo from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. today. There'll be heavy rain at times this morning with a risk of flooding in western counties. Rain will persist in the north and west through the day with further heavy falls, while drier intervals will develop elsewhere through the afternoon. It'll be mild and humid with highest temperatures of 13 to 15 degrees and fresh to strong south to southwest winds with high seas along Atlantic coasts. Tonight will be mostly cloudy with outbreaks of rain at times, heaviest and most prolonged in the north and northwest early in the night. It'll be mild, but turning cooler through the night, with lowest temperatures of 6 to 10 degrees in fresh southwest winds. Friday will see the best of the weather, as it remains mostly dry with sunny spells. Highest afternoon temperatures of just 8 to 12 degrees, however, in light to moderate westerly or variable breezes. There will be a period of wet and very windy weather, with stormy conditions possible on Saturday, bringing the risk of river and coastal flooding. It'll remain unsettled with windier, stormy conditions at times through the early days of next week. So please watch for further updates on our website and social media. That's all from me and the team at Met Éireann. Have a good morning.
It's 8 o'clock. You're with Morning Ireland on RT Radio 1 and the RT News Channel with Áine Lawler and Mary Wilson. The news in detail now with Brian Jennings.
The government has clarified that adoptees and survivors of mother and baby homes are legally entitled to access their personal data. Representative groups of former residents have welcomed the announcement. For those seeking information through GDPR laws, it will have to be proven that their application does not infringe on the rights of others. Mary Regan of Our Political Staff.
A row over the treatment of sensitive data currently in the possession of the Mother and Baby Homes Commission of Investigation has caused widespread distress for adoptees and survivors and led to a political backlash that has taken the coalition by surprise. In a statement last night, the government said it had a detailed reflection on the issues raised in recent days and acknowledges and regrets the genuine hurt felt by many people. The Minister for Children, Roderick O'Gorman, said he consulted with the Office of the Attorney General, who confirmed that GDPR laws do apply to the archive, meaning people will have the right to access personal information. However, he told RT News that anyone seeking to get information will have to prove that doing so doesn't infringe on the rights of others and doesn't undermine the work of the investigation. Its report is due to be submitted to government tomorrow. The Cabinet has committed to publishing it as soon as possible, but so far there's no definite timeline of when that will be.
Investigations are continuing into the deaths of a mother and her two children in South Dublin. Gardaí are treating the deaths as unexplained, and the house, located near Ballantyre, has been declared a crime scene. Samantha Librari reports.
A candlelit vigil was held in the Llewellyn estate last night as neighbours expressed their shock and grief at the tragedy that unfolded on their doorstep. The bodies of three members of one family, a 37-year-old woman, an 11-year-old girl and a 6-year-old boy, were found in the house in Llewellyn Court after neighbours said they hadn't seen the family in some time. Gardaí are currently treating the deaths as unexplained, but it's understood they're pursuing a number of lines of inquiry. Gardaí have been in contact with the partner of the woman and father of the children. Detectives have spoken to the man, who is distressed and has been given access to medical treatment. The bodies were removed from the scene last night, and the results of the post-mortem examinations will determine the outcome of this investigation, but the case has been allocated the resources of a murder investigation.
The National Public Health Emergency Team will hold its weekly meeting today to review the latest COVID-19 trends. The 14-day incidence rate is below 300 per 100,000 population for the first time in a week, Fergal O'Brien reports.
Today marks 1 week since the Level 5 restrictions were introduced to suppress COVID-19 in Ireland. Members of NPHET will meet later to assess the current situation and compliance with the measures, which are due to remain in place for another 5 weeks. Yesterday, 675 new virus cases were announced, the lowest figure since October 9th. It means the number of daily cases has been below 1,000 on 5 of the last 7 days. The 14-day incidence rate, the number of cases per 100,000 of the population, has also dropped and is below 300 for the first time in a week at 299. However, public health officials have stressed in recent days that it is too early to say if there are any definitive trends emerging.
EU leaders will attempt to make progress on common coronavirus testing and vaccine strategies during a video conference this afternoon. The move comes as a new surge of the virus takes firm hold across Europe. France is introducing a 4-week nationwide lockdown starting tomorrow, and Germany is closing all bars, restaurants and other social venues until the end of November. From Brussels, our Europe editor Tony Connolly.
Across the continent, the figures are showing a dramatic increase in infections, hospitalizations and deaths. Desperate to avoid the mistakes and divisions of the first wave, EU leaders will seek to coordinate the purchase and development of testing kits, including rapid antibody tests, which could help identify clusters of infections more quickly. The President of the European Council, Charles Michel, wants leaders to speed up vaccination plans to ensure that the first limited doses, should they become available, can be distributed quickly to those most in need. Member states will also be asked to mutually recognise each other's tests and to ensure that national contact tracing apps be interoperable across the EU to ensure that as much necessary travel can continue as possible. Tony Connolly, RTE News, Brussels.
Tesco is to create 450 new permanent jobs across the country. The supermarket chain is also generating an additional 700 seasonal positions for the Christmas period. Recruitment is already underway. Our business editor, Will Goodbody.
The positions to be filled include roles in assembly and fulfilment of customer orders for online delivery, drivers to deliver them, customer assistance, plus a variety of other roles in stores across the country. Tesco also said its store at the Douglas Shopping Centre will reopen in 2 weeks after a year-long closure following a fire. The announcement of the new jobs has been welcomed by the Taoiseach, who said it provided much-needed good news in challenging times. Tesco has already created 1,000 jobs since the COVID-19 pandemic began earlier this year.
Now the weather.
RT Radio 1 weather with Ulster Bank. Thinking of switching your mortgage? The Ulster Bank mortgage team are available to talk. Hail, rain or shine.
Wet and increasingly windy this morning with heavy rain at times and a risk of flooding in western counties. Drier intervals will develop mainly in the east and southeast this afternoon. Mild and humid, with highest temperatures 13 to 15 degrees. There's a warning that southwest winds will reach gale force at times on Irish coastal waters from Wicklow Head to Loophead to Malin Head and on the Irish Sea.
It is 7 minutes past eight on a rainy Thursday morning. Here's Fiona Kelly to tell us what it says in today's papers.
The deaths of a mother and her two children in Dublin, a clarification from the Attorney General regarding access to mother and baby homes records, and restrictive new lockdown measures across Europe are some of the stories covered on your front pages this morning. Those unexplained deaths of a 37-year-old woman and her two children, aged 6 and 11, in Llewellyn Court in South Dublin, generates the lead story in six of today's papers in The Republic. Residents attending the candlelit vigil on the quiet estate where the deaths occurred are pictured on the front of the Irish Times and Irish Independent, while pictures of Gardaí and forensics officers at the scene are carried on a number of today's other front pages. All of today's papers report that the family had been living in the house for about a year and that the children attended the local primary school. It's also reported that Gardaí had been in contact with the woman's husband and the children's father. The Irish Examiner and Irish Times find their lead stories elsewhere this morning. The Examiner leads with the government's clarification regarding the access which survivors of mother and baby homes are to be given after concerns were raised by furious survivors. Children's Minister Roderick O'Gorman is quoted saying that while the Attorney General has clarified that while access is permissible under strict conditions, all cases will be individually assessed. For its lead story, The Times reports on the restrictive measures being enforced all around Europe in the fight against COVID-19. Bars and restaurants have been shut for a month in Germany, where cases there have reached 15,000 a day, while France has gone into a second lockdown for all of November, as 254,000 cases were recorded there over the course of a week. Closer to home, the Irish News leads today with the death of a 17-year-old from Derry, who was one of nine COVID-19 deaths reported in Northern Ireland yesterday. For its lead story, the Belfast Telegraph reports on the £4.5 million which Stormont officials handed out to businesses which weren't eligible to receive grants under a small business support scheme in March. Sinn Féin received three unsolicited grants amounting to £30,000, which the party repaid last week. Elsewhere this morning, Dublin City Council is interested in acquiring a proposed 15-storey privately developed apartment block close to Eastlink Bridge for social housing. That's in the Times, as is a story about how prisoners at Mountjoy Prison have been given access to college lectures and tutorials during the pandemic in conjunction with Maynooth University in a move which may now become a permanent offering. The Examiner reports on the conviction of 48-year-old haulier Peter Barker at Ennis District Court for an offence related to the installation of a black box which was able to override and falsify the tachograph system on his truck. The Independent has a picture this morning of this year's Christmas window in Brown Thomas in Dublin, which, like everything else this year, has a virtual dimension. Barbara Power reports that the sister of Normal People actor Paul Mescal, Nell Mescal, a 17-year-old student from Maynooth, performs a song which features in a filmed segment of the display. And finally, The Examiner has a nice story on page 3 this morning about a refill shop which has been opened by an immigrant group in Killarney. Killarney Immigrant Support Services have opened the shop, which sells herbs, spices, nuts, olive oil and other organic foodstuffs, some of which are sourced locally. Customers bring their own jars and containers and pay for what they've bought based on weight. And Pádraig Corr reports that this is the latest in a number of refill shops which have been set up recently in Munster.
You're welcome back to Morning Ireland, and as we heard earlier, a candlelit vigil was held last night to remember a mother and her two young children who were found dead in a house in Dublin yesterday. Residents of Llewellyn Court in Rathfarnham in South Dublin expressed their grief and shock at the tragedy and described how difficult it was to explain what had happened to their own children. Our reporter Samantha Librari was at last night's vigil. She spoke to some of those who were there.
There's a little boy and a little girl here involved, and the little boy is only my daughter's age. It's, you know, it's just horrific. Like, and for the neighbourhood, we're a very close community here. We do an awful lot around here in this little area, say with the fairy garden and the new bench that we've put in. And as I say, we've neighbourhood watch. We've everything around here. So just to show your support in any little way, because there's not much you can actually do, just to show it out there that we are a community and we are thinking of this whole family at this horrible, horrible time.
Yeah, I just came here to show solidarity. It's absolutely devastating what's happened today in Llewellyn. It's great to see the residents come together here and united.
Shocked. We never thought it would happen in our own estate, but it does, so.
Over 40 years in this estate, and I never ever seen anything like this before in this estate, because it was always a quiet residential estate. And everybody looked out for everybody.
I think we're all still absolutely shocked. Most of us didn't know the family. They seemed to be a very private family. I think it's just the thought of particularly two children losing their life. It's just, I don't have the words. I can't.
And Samantha joins me now, and shock is the word there from the residents, summing up the reaction to these unfolding events, Samantha.
That's right, Mary. This house is nestled in a small, quiet cul-de-sac in Llewellyn Court, which is an estate on the border of Rathfarnham and Ballantyre in South Dublin. It's just a few minutes from Marley Park. And the neighbours say the estate is about 40 years old, and they described it as a close and settled community. It was midterm break yesterday, and there were an awful lot of young children out playing in the field. There was Halloween decorations in gardens and windows, a very normal picture there. And as you heard them mention there, they were very proud to show us the bench they recently installed for the older people living there in a fairy garden for younger residents. And it was at this location last night that they held that candlelit vigil to remember the mother and the two children who lost their lives. Neighbours said they were stunned and devastated at what happened. And as you heard them say, they admitted they didn't really know the family very well. The woman, her partner and two young children had been living there for about a year, and it's understood the couple moved to Ireland from outside of Europe some years ago. They were described as private people who kept to themselves, and the children attended the local primary school.
And how did Gardaí make this discovery yesterday?
Well, it was those neighbours who became concerned when they hadn't seen the family in some time. So they contacted Gardaí, and Gardaí called to the home just before midday yesterday, but they got no response. So they eventually forced entry to the property, and there they discovered the bodies of the 37-year-old mother, her 11-year-old daughter and her 6-year-old son. Now, the scene was immediately preserved and designated a crime scene, and the state pathologist was notified and a technical examination was carried out. And very quickly after the discovery, Gardaí said they were treating the deaths as unexplained. Now, it's understood they're pursuing a number of lines of inquiry. They're carrying out house-to-house interviews with those neighbours to establish the movements of the family in recent days, and they're also speaking to friends and family of the deceased. Now, Gardaí have been in contact with the partner of the woman and the father of the children. Detectives spoke to the man, who's said to be distressed, and he's been given access to medical treatment.
Do we know where this investigation is going now?
Well, the state pathologist attended the scene yesterday, and last night the bodies were removed from their home, and a post-mortem is due to be carried out today on the bodies of the mother and her two young children. Now, Gardaí say the results will determine the course of this investigation, which was described to me as a complex and very sensitive investigation, but it has been allocated at the moment all the resources of a murder investigation. We expect to hear more from Gardaí later today. But yesterday, Gardaí also took the unusual move of appealing to the public not to share comments about this case on social media. They say comments began circulating very soon after the incident came to light yesterday, and they described these comments as uninformed, and they also said they were extremely unhelpful to this criminal investigation.
For now, Samantha Librari, thank you.
Well, after a long cabinet meeting yesterday, the government released a statement yesterday evening confirming that adoptees and survivors of mother and baby's homes are legally entitled to access their own personal data. For more on this, we're joined on the line by Children's Minister Roderick O'Gorman. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning, Anya.
So in terms of this cabinet meeting yesterday and this long discussion, were you the minister who brought the latest advice from the Attorney General about access to personal records to the cabinet's attention?
Yeah, we discussed the issue of the advice from the Attorney General, and the Attorney General partook in the cabinet meeting and provided written advice to my department subsequent to the cabinet meeting last night. And in that advice, he stated that once the archive of the Commission of Mother and Baby Homes is transferred to my department, GDPR will apply to that. So that means that individuals will be able to make subject access requests to my department, and my department will have to examine each request on an individual basis, and my department will have to consider whether the request impacts the rights and freedoms of others, and whether any restrictions on the right to access would be necessary and proportionate to safeguard the operations of Commission of Investigations. But the burden would fall on my department to show the need for any restriction. So my department now is going to engage with the Data Protection Commissioner to ensure that this process of examining data access requests when they start to happen is done in a way that's fully GDPR compliant.
It's just that's what campaigners and opposition have been saying about the right of access under GDPR. They've been shouting it from the rooftops. Did the Attorney General change his advice on this since last week?
No, I've been engaging substantially with the Attorney General over the last week. I suppose I've been engaging substantially with his office since this legislation, the database legislation, was first introduced in the Dáil. And then last Monday, the Data Protection Commissioner brought in a very specific query to my department regarding the original 2004 Commission of Investigations Act and an amendment that was made to that in 2018. So as soon as we received that particular request, we sent it on to the Attorney General's office for their advice, and I've been engaging substantially with the Attorney General over the weekend, and the Attorney General's office has been very supportive on this whole issue, and the Attorney General provided his advice to the government and to my department yesterday. I think it's important, I think it's significant for survivors, but I think it's probably also worth saying that this doesn't answer all issues that have come up in the context of the debate over the last 2 weeks about access to information, and just two of the other decisions made at the government cabinet meeting last night, one a commitment to bring in proper information and tracing legislation so adopted people can trace their birth parents, and secondly then the issue of creating a national archive where we can compile the information from the various reports and inquests that have taken place into institutional advice abuse in Ireland, and ensure that these records are, mm-hmm. are properly managed and there's proper and appropriate access to them.
Just to, and we'll talk about all of those issues, but just to clarify the timeline. So the legislation has passed through the Oireachtas last Thursday and Friday, signed mm-hmm. by the President on Sunday. On Monday, the Data Protection Commissioner makes representation.
Sorry, it was the previous Monday. The previous Monday, the request came in from the Data Protection Commissioner on the specific issue of the 2004 Act, and we immediately sent the issue on to the Attorney General, and we've been engaging with the Attorney General over the last week on the specific query.
Okay, so is it a change in law or a change in policy?
I think it's a clarification of the application of GDPR to the to the database, and as I say, I think it's significant, and it is something that, you know, I'd flagged up in the Dáil, that I recognised there was a wide range of views on this particular issue. I think it is significant for survivors as regards access to personal information, mm-hmm. but as I've said, and in fairness, I think most campaign groups acknowledge this itself doesn't address all the issues surrounding access to information in
Absolutely.
The archive of
I think
of
the
this
phrase you used
and others.
I think the phrase you used was it wasn't morally sustainable to deny people access to their records. It's just if you could have clarified that it was legally possible under GDPR at the time, that could have provided more reassurance, couldn't it? And in terms of what you have clarified, there are terms and conditions, aren't there? There are two tests.
Yeah, there are two tests. As I said, when a subject access request comes in, it has to be examined to see would the request impact on the rights and freedoms of others. And specifically, coming from the 2004 Act, there's a requirement to examine whether any restriction on the right to access is necessary and proportionate to safeguard the operation of commissions and investigation and the cooperation of future witnesses. So both of those tests would have to be applied by my department when a subject access request comes in. The burden is on us to show that there is the need for the restriction. And as I said, we'll be engaging. This is a new process that my department will be undertaking once the archive arrives with us. So we'll be engaging with the Data Protection Commissioner to make sure we get all advice and support as to how to apply that in a manner that's GDPR compliant.
Because again, a lot of campaigners, Simon McGar, the solicitor, is raising concerns that your second test in itself might be too strict a limit on an individual's right of access under that very same GDPR law.
Well, look, as I say, we're going to engage with the DPC as regards the advice we've received on the test that has to be applied, look, we'll keep that under review. But I think, I suppose, the key principle that's been established here is that right of access, the right to put subject access requests to my department, and I think, as I say, that's a significant okay. from the point of view of giving survivors access to particularly valuable personal information.
And so you're willing to meet with campaigners, are you, in relation to that second test? You're willing to show flexibility there and amend it?
Well, look, I'm absolutely willing to meet with groups, and look, I stated that in the Dáil last week, and I'm in the process of arranging to engage with survivors groups and the kind of advocates for them in the near future. I think I acknowledge that I should have done more of that when the initial database legislation was being brought forward in the Dáil. I'd seen it as very much a technical amendment, but I think and I acknowledge now that anything that touches on the legacy issues in this country has kind of a deep rawness for many of the survivors. So I'm absolutely committed to engaging with survivors groups and with advocacy groups on this specific issue, but also on the government's wider response to legacy issues. And I think that was very much central to the message coming from government yesterday, the need to put survivors at the absolute centre of all our responses to these legacy issues as we go forward.
But you didn't. You saw it as a technical amendment, as you've just said. Was that a rookie mistake?
I've acknowledged I made a mistake in how I initially didn't engage with survivors groups on this particular issue, and I'm hoping that the very substantive range of measures that government discussed yesterday, and I think we focused on one, but there are a range of issues that the government highlighted following our lengthy meeting yesterday, and I'm hoping that those measures will be seen as a step to build back trust. And I note that survivors groups have welcomed the commitments that the government made yesterday following our cabinet meeting.
Do you accept that this same data protection rule, the right of access to personal information about yourself, that covers the McAleese and Ryan Commission archives as well?
I don't have specific advice on that point, Anya, but I imagine that's something that the government are going to have to examine as well. And I think that's why I think the discussion we had about an appropriate archiving system for all of these various commissions and inquiries that have taken place into institutional abuse is really important, because I think other European countries have shown examples, and I think the example cited most often is the approach that Germany took to the files of the Stasi, the East German secret police, files that kind of reveals that many families had informers within them and were very divisive, but a particular approach was taken to archiving those files that allowed for information to be put out there and recorded in an appropriate way. And I think that's certainly a potential model that we could look at for Ireland in dealing with the various inquiries into institutional abuse. And during the context of the debate last week, I asked that maybe the Oireachtas Committee on Children, Equality, Disability and Integration would examine the potential approaches to the treatment of the archives of these various commissions of inquiry.
You're getting the report of the commission, the actual report itself, tomorrow, I understand. How long before its contents will you be in a position to make them public? Claire McGettrick said earlier, better right than rushed, but a lot of people very keen to see what's in that report.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste and indeed everyone in government spoke yesterday about the need to publish this report as quickly as possible. My department will receive the report tomorrow and we'll also send it on to the Attorney General. And in order to speed up the process of reviewing the entire report at government meeting yesterday, it was agreed to give the Attorney General's office additional resources so that the entire report can be read and analysed quickly and we can publish it as quickly as possible. I'm not in a position to give a specific date right now, but I will emphasise that across all members of the Cabinet, the desire to get it published as quickly as possible and to, you know, to achieve that, we are giving these additional resources to the Attorney General's office to undertake a full review of the report.
And as you said, your mistake here was to underestimate the hurt and the pain caused by all of this. Your predecessor, Catherine Zappone, she tried to bring forward legislation that would sort out this whole business of access to records, and her legislation failed. Why do you think you're in a position to succeed where she couldn't?
Well, I think, you know, and I, when I took over as minister, I spoke with Catherine specifically on this point. And, you know, a very substantial amount of work was done by Catherine and by the department on this issue. So, I can build on that. I think it's important now to engage with survivors groups and also groups representing adopted people to, I suppose, ascertain the key issues. And I think that the particular thing we need to do is look at this test that was established in a constitutional case in the late 1990s as regards balancing the right of privacy of a birth mother with the right to access to information for an adopted person. And I think both the law but also the reality has changed a lot since then, and people can now, through, you know, DNA tests and the like that are available online, find out a huge amount of material and find connections with relatives that don't require any of the traditional return to records in adoption societies. So I think we have to understand our approach to this issue in a modern context, and I look forward to engaging with groups representing adopted people to see how we can secure that right to fundamental early life information.
Children's Minister Roderick O'Gorman, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Morning Ireland.
Tesco is to create 450 new permanent jobs across the country. The supermarket chain is also generating an additional 700 seasonal positions for the Christmas period. Glanbia has reported an increase in overall revenue in the third quarter despite challenging conditions. The Kilkenny-based nutrition group intends to launch a share repurchase programme of up to €50 million. Contactless payments hit a record high in the third quarter of this year, with more than 182 million payments valued at almost €2.9 billion, according to figures published today by Banking and Payments Federation Ireland. Online marketplace eBay rode the e-commerce wave to better than expected third quarter results, but its shares fell 5% in aftermarket trading. Let's take a look at the currencies. €1 buys 90.3 pence sterling and $1 17 cents.
I actually can't see Des Cahill because he's remotely, because we're all doing this social distancing, but I'm told he's just raced into studio. I hope you've caught your breath and you're here to give us the sports news.
Indeed, Des. I have. All the training is paying off for me. We're starting with news of Cork City, and after a traumatic year, the club has been sold. Let's go live to Cork and join Tony O'Donoghue for the details.
Thanks very much indeed, Des. Yes, traumatic is right. A year that began with uncertainty. The club, not sure if they were able to even start the season. Then we had the COVID interruption and the season finished in relegation for a club that only 3 years ago were double champions. Now, at the start of the season, they required help from Preston North End and their owner, Trevor Hemmings, in order to pay a tax revenue bill and other liabilities. And last night, the Forest, the members that are entrusted with running and owning the club, the supporters club, they voted on a clause, a call-out option, to sell the club to Trevor Hemmings, Preston North End's owner, a company called Grovemore, for €1. Now, obviously, he would take over the existing liabilities of the club as well. It was a difficult decision for a lot of supporters to make, although I understand the vote eventually, it needed just a simple majority, but eventually was a 70-30 split. But a lot of people voted with their hand over their nose. They were just disappointed because, you know, the community base of the club, the fact that the fan-owned club had saved the club in 2010 when they were in examinership and had brought them to heights. But chasing that dream of success for League of Ireland clubs has proven time and again to be a boom and a bust cycle, and the same is true of Cork. Grovemore have said that they will do their due diligence regarding the current liabilities, and they've committed to cash flow and resources to bring an immediate return for Cork City to the Premier Division. A key to that for them, though, is talks with the Munster Football Association for a freehold interest in Turner's Cross. They say linking the stadium is fundamental to the long-term prospects of the club. Now, that could prove difficult. Apart from a brief period at Bishopstown, all the various iterations of Cork football have never owned their own stadium. But Trevor Hemmings, who people will know from, he's a three-time Grand National winner, he has a lot of connections with Cork, and Preston do as well. Current internationals Alan Brown and Sean Maguire came from Cork, of course, and many others. And Trevor Hemmings himself owns Trebulgan, the East Cork Holiday Village, and a number of stud farms in Cork. So they're hoping that this will be a bright future for the club. But as I say, a lot of the fans voted for this motion to go ahead, but with a heavy heart.
So Cork City relegated. Finn Harps, though, took a huge step last night to avoid perhaps getting relegated with Cork. Finn Harps beat St Pat's 3-2 to boost their chance of avoiding the relegation playoff. They're now just 2 points behind Shelburne, St Pat's and Derry, and a couple of games to go. The big match tonight, of course, sees Dundalk take on Arsenal at the Emirates Stadium in the Europa League. Dundalk manager Filippo Giovagnoli says they'll try to match Arsenal's intensity and get a result that would be a huge boost for Irish football. And there's a massive difference between the two clubs. And it was suggested to him, perhaps the biggest illustration of this, is that Arsenal have a player, Mesut Ozil, who is paid £350,000 a week and he cannot get in their squad of 25 players.
There is a big difference, and but what was the question? What do you think I have to respond to answer to this? I mean, it's quite obvious that there is like a heavyweight boxer against a super lightweight, right? So we will just need to try to make them run uncomfortable a little bit. Yes, I mean, everything is in tomorrow in this game is obvious. The difference, the quality. Let's make the passion, something maybe bigger in outside.
It will be great, not for me, for the club, for the city, for Dundalk, for Ireland, to get some point here, a result. It will be an amazing achievement for not for me, for everyone.
A lovely story last night on Dundalk TV. They were filming the Dundalk players training at the Emirates Stadium. The Dundalk players thrilled by it. And one of them in particular, Michael Duffy, is a huge Arsenal fan. And he revealed his confirmation name comes from an Arsenal player.
We've a guest interviewee, Pat Hoban, wants to know what's your confirmation name?
Thierry.
Too
big an Arsenal fan I was.
Really? Is that serious?
Yeah, Henry, he was a man.
is it that side that was the Arsenal team you grew up watching?
He was my idol like when I was growing up, and asked for Thierry. That's my confirmation name, and they said no at the start, but then the teacher came back 2 weeks later and says he was a saint, so you can have it.
That's Michael Duffy. Now, good luck to Dundalk. In the other games tonight, Celtic go to Lille, Rangers play Lech Poznan, Spurs go to Antwerp, and Leicester City play AEK Athens. Last night's Champions League headlines, well, Marcus Rashford grabbed most of them. He came off the bench to score a hat-trick as United beat RB Leipzig 5-0. Mason Greenwood and Anthony Martial got the two other goals. And Chelsea had a very impressive 4-0 win away to the Russian side Krasnodar. Lionel Messi scored as Barcelona won 2-0 at Juventus. Barca finished that game with two 17-year-olds on the pitch. Imagine being 17, that's like fifth year in school and playing alongside Messi in the Champions League. In rugby, Ireland's final women's Six Nations game against France has been postponed due to an outbreak of COVID-19 in the French squad. The game was due to be played in Donnybrook on Sunday. It's now hoped to play the game next month. In Gaelic games, Waterford Intermediate Football champions Dungarvan have been stripped of their county title for fielding a player who is awaiting the results of a COVID-19 test, which subsequently returned positive. The county board confirmed that the penalties have been accepted by the club, so Dungarvan lose the county title and individual suspensions have been imposed on 6 members. Don Martin continued his impressive form in the Tour of Spain. Cycling yesterday, he was 3rd on stage 8 and remains 3rd overall, 28 seconds behind the leader, Richard Carapaz. And in racing, John Ox back amongst the winners at Dundalk last night when Ross Coakley steered Riga Legal to victory. And today's racing is at Clonmel, beginning at 1:20.
Now, with 6 days to polling in the US presidential election, Donald Trump and Joe Biden will both campaign today in the key battleground state of Florida. More than 75 million Americans have already voted through early in-person voting and mail-in ballots. Election officials in many states are warning that it is now too late for voters to return absentee ballots by post, and they're encouraging people instead to deliver their ballots by hand or vote in person.
Well, both Donald Trump and Joe Biden will campaign in Florida today. They'll be in the same areas, but not at the same time, so unlikely to bump into each other. Joe Biden will hold his signature drive-in rallies in Broward County and Tampa. Donald Trump will hold one of his big traditional rallies also in Tampa, but earlier in the day, he'll then travel on to North Carolina. Why the focus on Florida? Well, because as always, it is one of the most important swing states and also, of course, one of the most unpredictable. It's one of the few swing states this time around where Joe Biden does not have a big lead in the opinion polls. It's pretty much neck and neck there. Florida, crucial for Donald Trump. If he loses this state next week, it could make his re-election impossible. And he has spent huge amounts of time and money campaigning there. He moved his official residence to Florida. He cast his early ballot there last week. Francis Rooney is a Republican congressman in Florida. He says he may not vote for Donald Trump himself because of his handling of the coronavirus. He's now an undecided voter. We spoke to him for RTE's podcast series States of Mind, and he told us that the race in Florida will be incredibly close.
I think everything is so up in the air and agitated and highly partisan that it's hard to say what's going to happen, but it's going to be close. I think that there's going to be a lot more voters on both sides, and I think there's more voters now that won't say truthfully how they're going to vote than ever, because there's so much angst on all sides. No one wants to lose friends or that kind of thing over it.
And that was the Republican Congressman Francis Rooney. Lots of speculation as well, Brian, that this election result could be disputed, that it could end up in the courts. And of course, we've already had a series of legal battles in individual states over voting issues.
Yeah, that's right. And some of those rulings have been pretty headline grabbing, Mary. Like yesterday, a Michigan judge overturned a ban on openly carrying guns at polling stations on election day in Michigan. But most of the court rulings, yes, have been around voting issues and issues of voting deadlines. The US Supreme Court yesterday ruled that election officials in two key battleground states, Pennsylvania and North Carolina, can accept absentee ballots for several days after election day. This was a win for Democrats. Republicans had opposed those moves. Earlier in the week, however, Republicans had a bit of a win, the court refusing to extend voting deadlines for Wisconsin. All of this means that in some states, votes will be counted for days and days after election day, meaning we may not get an overall result on election night. The expectation is that many Republican voters will turn up and vote in that traditional in-person way on election day. So you could see this scenario where on election night, it looks like Donald Trump has won a state, perhaps like Pennsylvania. And this is being dubbed the red mirage. But then we could then see what's being dubbed the blue shift, which is a flood of postal votes coming in the days after election day that go for Joe Biden. Many expect that Donald Trump could then cry foul. He could claim fraud. He could dispute the results and take it to the Supreme Court. Last night, the US president addressed supporters in Arizona. He encouraged them to vote on election day, and he promised them a red wave.
So we made America great again. We created the greatest economy in the history of the world. And then we had the plague come in from China. And now we're doing it again. Our numbers are unbelievable. And by the way, you're going to have a very big number. I even say hold off in your vote until it happens, because a lot of you want to wait till Tuesday anyway. It's going to be a great, great red wave.
Brian, we know Joe Biden is continuing to lead in the polls, but has there been any tightening in the race in these final days of campaigning?
No, Mary, no great signs of any major shifts in the polls. Joe Biden continuing to hold a big national lead of between 9 and 12%. But of course, what's far more important are the polls in the key battleground swing states. Here, too, Joe Biden is in front, but by smaller margins. Very small margins, as I mentioned earlier, when we look at Florida, also very small margins in a state like Arizona, where there's only 1 or 2 points in it. Now, I speak to Trump supporters all the time here in the US, and they tell me without fail that they are not worried about the opinion polls. And they say if the opinion polls were right, Hillary Clinton would be in the White House. And they were wrong back in 2016. And I suppose they are right on that point. The difference this time, however, is that Joe Biden's lead is far bigger than Hillary Clinton's at this time. Pollsters also said they have adjusted their survey models to account for groups that were underrepresented or ignored 4 years ago. Groups like non-college educated white males who backed Donald Trump in big numbers. And of course, the other big difference this time around is the record number of early votes being cast. More than 75 million Americans have already voted through early in-person voting or mail-in ballots. And to put that in context, that figure of 75 million, that's a third of all registered voters and half the number of total ballots cast back in 2016.
And that was our Washington correspondent, Brian O'Donovan. It's 6 minutes to nine.
And as Des was saying, Saint Thierry and every other saint is likely going to be invoked by the people of Dundalk tonight ahead of that Arsenal game. It's absolutely huge for the town. And our Northeast correspondent, Sinead Hussey, has been speaking to some past Dundalk players and fans ahead of tonight's big clash.
This is all, some of my memorabilia from my football career.
It's 57 years ago, but John Murphy remembers it like it was yesterday.
That's the famous programme from the Zurich match.
He was the captain the day Dundalk made history, becoming the first Irish club to win an away match in a European competition. Dundalk had lost the first leg at home, but secured a 2-1 win when they travelled to Zurich.
We went to Zurich. We were completely calm about the situation. We knew we could play better than we did in Dublin. And we came away with a historic victory, winning 2-1, that's still in the record books. And it's something like for myself at my time of life now, it's great to look back on. And it's a wonderful achievement.
So, could history be made again tonight? John Murphy says regardless, this is a special night for the League of Ireland club.
like, it's going to be a very tough game for Dundalk. We're playing against the elite of the Premier League, you may say. They transferred a man there last week for 45 million, you know, and that shows you the gap between League of Ireland and the Premier League in England. But it's like everything else. This is what every player wants. This is the pinnacle of his career, to meet and play against teams like Arsenal.
The Emirates will, of course, be empty tonight apart from officials. But there's no doubting the huge support here in Dundalk. Aoife Mullen is one of many fans who would have travelled to London had the restrictions not been in place.
It is a pity, and I know that there would have been a big Dundalk contingent going over to London. We'll have our fingers and toes crossed for December and see how things go then, but it is unfortunate. But as I say, it's a good boost this week and it's a good distraction. I think even for fans that don't necessarily support Dundalk, if they're footballing fans in Ireland, they're getting behind Dundalk, and 2020 seems to be the year that keeps on taking. So if we can get something back, we'll cling on to it and we'll look forward to this game. So there may be a restriction on numbers and celebrations, but there's no limit on support, I don't think.
Dundalk's progression to the group stages of the Europa League comes after their most turbulent season in years. Supporter Donal Sweeney says whatever the result, it's a huge achievement to get this far.
When you think a very short number of months ago, the club was in utter turmoil. And I suppose had somebody then said that the club would be in the Europa League and playing the likes of Arsenal, you wouldn't have believed them. So it's fabulous, really, that this opportunity has come around for the club and the supporters. It's not going to be easy. I suppose all Dundalk supporters will be hoping for a good performance and maybe keeping the score down.
Former chairman and co-owner of the club, Paul Brown, agrees, but believes the infamous Dundalk support will be missed in the Emirates tonight.
The Emirates would like our supporters there, the banter and the noise that our supporters bring. Like, we bring it throughout the league, as everybody knows, and then it would be a fine thing to have it in the Emirates, you know. I think the Emirates might have seen some supporters like that, you know. It's going to be very, very difficult. We have to be realistic here, you know. But at the end of the day, if you can get something out of it, something, it'll be fine, you know.
Whatever the final score, it's a special night for the club and its supporters. And it's a game 82-year-old John Murphy would give anything to be playing in.
To be honest with you, if I could find me boots, I'd love to be running out there myself, like, you know. It's a great thrill for the players, you know. They'll never have this again, like. Very, very lucky if they get it again.
He's absolutely right, isn't he? That was former Dundalk captain John Murphy ending that report by our North East correspondent, Sinead Hussey. I know we're supposed to be neutral, Mary, but we're allowed to say good luck,
we
Dundalk.
We are. Yeah. Absolutely. Good luck to Dundalk.
It's 9:15. Let's find out a little bit more now before we go about an initiative which we heard about from Fiona when she was telling us what it says in today's papers. And it's a story in the Irish Examiner about Killarney going green with its first refill shop. This is an initiative that has been seen in a couple of other centres in Munster. And this one is being run by Killarney Immigrant Support Services. And to tell us more about it, I'm joined by Marilyn Coonahan. Marilyn, good morning to you.
Good morning, Anya. How are you?
Now, I know I'm looking at the pictures in the paper and I'm seeing a lovely shop. I'm seeing all these fantastic goods you've got to dispense and a gorgeous garden. So it's more than just a refill shop. It's a whole enterprise, Marilyn. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. It's actually... Can I say something about it?
Please do.
Yeah, exactly. We actually have a community garden and we do kind of market once a week. And we always talk about kind of... trying to reduce waste and all this composting and about the environment. It's a very topical subject. And then we talk about, really, it's so hard to kind of, in a town like Killarney, probably what we need is a kind of a physical presence, a shop where, a refill shop. But we never planned on opening it until during the lockdown, an opportunity arose when one of the coffee shops in the middle of the town, a very ideal place, closed down. So I went to my board, we discuss about it, we consult other people, we talk about it again, and then eventually we decided to go for it, open a coffee shop, but this time with a different slant, maybe put a corner where we could put a refill shop. And the idea really is we already had a social enterprise before where we provide lunches in the school, which we use our produce from the garden. The vegetable ingredients that we use is from our own community garden, and it also creates employment to asylum seekers and other migrants. So this way, so we went for it, and it was very kind of supported by the community, and there's a lot of interest. And it just actually shows that a lot of people are thinking about doing something for the environment, about being plastic free and things like that. But it's just that there's need to be a physical presence to kind of reminding them about, okay, we have it here, and really there's a lot of positive feedback about, oh, Killarney really needs it and all this, and we are the first refill shop in Killarney. And we also have a coffee shop with it, and we try to use everything organic as much as possible, and if not locally produced, or if not, at least it's made in Ireland, so to kind of reduce that food mile.
Well, that's an absolutely brilliant pitch that you've done for it there, and I know in particular it's well documented, isn't it, that for immigrants and people who are in tough situations, the capacity to grow your own food, the capacity to develop real links in the community, it's incredibly therapeutic, isn't it?
It is. And in a way, our social enterprise, there's a kind of a lot of there's an environmental impact, of course. There is an economic impact, and there is also a social impact. And in a way, kind of integration happens in a kind of, in an organic manner, because the people are there working, even in our community garden, in our lunch project in the school. It's not forced. They're there working, they meet other people. And
Marilyn, you know, I'm afraid, thank you so much for talking to us about this fantastic development. I can, obviously we're all with it staying within our limits, but anyone in Kerry who can get to Killarney within their 5 kilometre limit, that sounds absolutely fantastic, that refill shop there, and a really interesting social enterprise, which we just heard about from Marilyn Coonahan. It's 2 minutes to 9.